This should not be this hard. Oh my goodness. Just stop talking.
What's up, guys? Welcome to this week's episode of the No Gimmicks Podcast. I'm Brady Leonard.
I'm Josiah Hughes. And I'm not watching football yet because the game isn't coming on until 4:30. You have a little bit more of my attention this time.
The Steelers don't come on until 8, I think, or 8:15 or something like that. So football isn't even on my radar for the next few hours. It's weird that we've been talking about football so much. We're about to talk about boxing later in the show, too.
When did we start caring about sports so much?
When did you start caring about sports? I've known you for a long time, and this is like a 2017 development.
Dude, no, yeah, but when I first met you, you would get pissed off if people talked about sports. You're like, I don't have time for that.
I always talked about MMA.
Yeah, you talk about MMA. But that's kind of where I'm at. I mean, that's pretty much the only sport that matters. Right now, I mean, I care about the Jaguars because I live in Jacksonville.
And they happen to be good for once.
It's pretty cool to watch. It's not as miserable as it has been. So I'm taking advantage of it.
It's a miracle.
It's a miracle.
It's a miracle.
Besides, football is like a social sport. Brings the country together.
Fist fights on TV on a Saturday night also bring people together.
Yes.
In my opinion. Nothing brings people together like a good old-fashioned fist fight. So we had a great guest today. We had an excellent guest today, Ariel Davidson from The Federalist. She was very generous with her time. We had a great chat. I think you guys will like it. We talked a lot about, you guessed it, sexual harassment in Congress. I really hope we can stop talking about that at some point soon, but I don't really see the light at the end of the tunnel yet. Unfortunately, we also talked about President Trump officially recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and a bunch of other stuff. I think you guys will like it. Definitely follow Ariel on Twitter and check out her stuff at The Federalist and keep up with what she's doing. Very, very smart, awesome guest. I'm sure we'll have her back soon. Without further ado, here's our interview with Ariel Davidson. What's up, guys? We're here with Ariel Davidson. Ariel, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. I'm glad we could finally make this work out, so that's exciting.
Definitely, definitely. So, let's just jump right into the news of the week. We've been getting really depressing on the show lately. I feel like not a lot of positive stuff, but there was some actually really positive stuff going on this week. Let's start with President Trump officially recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and instructing the State Department to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I did not think that this was something Trump was going to do, but I'm happy to be wrong.
So I think that the Trump Jerusalem announcement, you know, I think was a very exciting announcement, but also sort of, as I've told people, a statement of the obvious, right? So, you know, Israel as a sovereign nation has declared Jerusalem to be her capital, and therefore us respecting her declaration. You know, there were lots of tweets I saw and even news articles claiming that Trump has moved the capital of Israel. No, Israel has always identified her capital as Jerusalem. We're just, you know, Trump is just choosing to accept reality. Yeah. And for me, you know, what's been most upsetting about this whole announcement is that all of the protests across both the Arab world and Europe have been completely sort of portrayed as anti-Zionist protests or just protests about specifically Jerusalem, when in fact, almost all of the protests have a very anti-Semitic nature to them. I mean, there was one protest in Sweden, I think it was yesterday, that the protesters were chanting something about killing the Jews. And there was also a synagogue in Sweden that was firebombed yesterday by a group of men in masks. And so to me, this conflation of Jews in Israel is really interesting because so many times you hear people on the left say, no, when we're criticizing Israel or when we're criticizing Jerusalem, we're just criticizing the state of Israel. We're not criticizing, you know, Jews in general. But then to see that all of these attacks in Europe are being committed against Jews who might have no connection to Israel in terms of politically or, you know, in terms of their citizenship, is pretty alarming. And I haven't really seen anyone in the mainstream media condemn these attacks as grossly anti-Semitic and even terrorist attacks. And to me, the last thing I'll leave it at that is that when we look at sort of the Charlottesville and how quick the media was to condemn these neo-Nazis, why is this any different? You know, why is it that a whole group of people marching down a main street in Sweden screaming, kill the Jews, is somehow permissible? But when it's in Charlottesville, it's not. I think they're both horrible and they should both be readily condemned. But, you know, we're in this age of I don't know if it's political correctness. I don't know if it's just an anti-Israel bias within the media. I don't know if it's, I'm not sure what it is, but it's probably a mixture of both of those things. So, you know, that's my little Jerusalem rant for you guys.
Yeah, and I really don't buy the difference between anti-Semitic behavior and anti-Zionist stuff. I don't really see the difference. It all seems anti-Semitic to me. It just doesn't seem like a strong argument from these people protesting and stuff like that. The Arab reaction is predictable. The Palestinian Authority called for a day of rage, which is something they do actually quite often. And from what I understand, that basically just means they're encouraging their citizens to go out and riot and kill Jews, essentially. Day of rage also sounds like something a toddler's reaction to hearing something you disagree with is to rage. Palestinians and toddlers apparently share that. But the reaction from the left, the political left, is anti-Semitic as well, and that's a little bit more surprising than the Palestinians' response. I mean, I don't know. I'm always shocked anytime a topic surrounding Israel comes up to see the political left kind of be exposed for their Jew hatred. I mean, really, every Democratic politician essentially slammed Trump for this move, even though, of course, Congress has passed dozens of times, you know, resolutions to actually, you know, turn this into law, but they conveniently forgot about that and hammered Trump for it. But I don't know. I think this is really exposing a lot of anti-Semitism in this country. What do you think about that?
I mean, I do. I also think that this is showing a battle for the heart of the Democratic Party right now. You have progressive factions, and then you have the Nancy Pelosi section of the party, and then you have the Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren section. And so they are the sort of establishment Democrats fighting with the progressive side, and it's really become a tug of war for what their identity will be. And Israel is just one more hill for them to battle on, because historically speaking, support for Israel has pretty much, in a political sense, at least from a superficial level, been pretty bipartisan. Most times Israel has gotten the support she's needed from both the Democrats and support that she deserves from both the left and the right. At this point, we're seeing a weird change in policy now where even Democrats who have in the past been somewhat supportive of Israel have sort of shirked away from her. And I think a lot of that has to do with the more progressive factions of the Democratic Party being infected with this intersectionality sort of garbage, which, you know, promotes this Marxist view of the world of oppressor and oppressed, and Israel is seen as an oppressive state. It's all based on sort of propaganda. But it's a digestible narrative for a lot of people on the left, especially young people who can avoid thinking critically about issues. And, you know, I think it also gives a nice safe haven for those who are anti-Semitic, and they can just profess themselves to be anti-Zionist. I think there really isn't a difference any longer. I'm not really sure if there ever was a difference, but I think now more than ever, like you said, it's become very clear that the two are pretty much synonymous. And that to me is a sad day for U.S. politics in some ways, because we've approached an era now where anti-Semitism is becoming increasingly normalized. But I'm proud of Trump for being able to speak freely and say, you know, we won't cow to terrorist organizations, and we won't allow anti-Semitic terrorist jihadist groups to determine our foreign policy. Yeah. And that's a good day in America.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The point that I usually try to make when I talk to people about this is, yes, the state of Israel makes mistakes like any other state. And there's definitely things you can criticize about. As far as the intricacies of that scenario, it's way too complicated for my pay grade. But at the same time, the state of Israel is fighting for its existence, its right to exist. And not just the state and the government, but the actual individuals living in that country are fighting for their lives and not just in a metaphorical sense. So I think that's something that gets lost in the West when we're separated from that life and death aspect of the Palestinian struggle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think when we talk about Israel, when they say she doesn't have a right to exist, we say, okay, where are you promoting a second Holocaust of my people then? You know, because I'm a Jew, and there are, I believe, 6 million Jews living in Israel. So if Israel were to become an Arab state, the Jews would no longer be able to live there peacefully and be able to practice their religion freely. So where would you like them to go?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a horrible, horrifying question to ask someone. And you know what? even anti-Zionists don't usually have an answer, or they're, if they do have an answer, it's disgusting.
Yeah.
So, you know, I found that that's the best way to get to the crux of what an anti-Zionist is arguing, which is essentially wiping out the Jewish people. Where, you know, asking them, where do you see transplanting a whole country of people? Where do you see them going? And they don't have an answer. And like I said, if they do have an answer, it's disgusting and disturbing. So that's how I am able to sort of expose anti-Zionism for what it is. And I found it to be a pretty powerful tool. Because when you get down to it, anti-Zionism isn't just arguing because of the precarious position of Israel and where she's located in the number of enemies she has, arguing against the existence of the Israeli state. It's really not just about borders. It's about a group of people being able to practice their religion freely and live in peace.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, again, like you were saying, is sort of lost from the Western dialogue. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
In a really tragic and unfortunate way. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm pretty open about, you know, the reason why I support Israel is strictly biblical. I mean, I know our listeners absolutely hate it when me and Josiah talk about religion, but, you know, we are both Christians, and I believe it's Genesis 12, I think, when God tells the Israelites, "I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse." And I mean, I take that seriously. I mean, historically speaking, you know, if the left, you know, chooses Israel as a hill to die on, that might be a hill they actually die on. There's been a lot of people wiped out for not having Israel's back. So, yeah, just on a biblical standpoint, I absolutely have to support Israel.
Well, it's also, you know, if you are a practicing Christian and you want to go visit the holy sites in the Middle East, particularly in Israel, right, you're able to do that. When it's under, you know, Israeli control, Israel has created a safe haven in the Middle East for anyone to practice their religion freely, as long as you're not violent. And so, you know, you can go into Israel, and they have a German Lutheran church in Israel. They have Orthodox churches in Israel. They have mosques. I mean, it's unbelievable if you sort of look at the ability of Israel to sort of be a place and a safe haven for anyone to practice their religion in any way, shape, or form they'd like, as long as they're not hurting others in the process. And that's a beautiful thing and such a rarity in the Middle East. I mean, it's the only place where women can freely enjoy the same rights as men, and also where anyone of any creed can practice their religion. So to look, you know, this is something I think just it's supporting Israel isn't necessarily just the right thing to do, it's the moral thing to do. And that to me is sort of the crux of one of the many reasons why I'm supportive. Also, just Jerusalem as the eternal capital of the Jewish people, you know, since biblical times, that's something that is inherent in my understanding of the Jewish connection to Israel. But Israel as a sovereign state from a political sense.
Yeah.
Does a wonderful and beautiful thing in the Middle East that no other country has been able to pull off.
Yeah, and if you think about it, Israel is the only state in that region of the world that promotes progressive values. So
right.
Why do they hate them so much? You know,
taking religion out of it completely. I mean, it would seem ridiculous if we weren't in complete support of the only democracy in the region, the only liberal government in the region. Of course, they're going to be our allies. And if you take religion out of it completely, they still are the only country in the area that shares Western values and Western culture. And yeah, and also, and we don't need to go down this road, but I don't fully understand the Muslim connection to Jerusalem. Obviously, Muslim leaders have conquered Israel a few times throughout history. But I mean, there's nothing about Jerusalem or Israel in the Quran. Muhammad never stepped foot in Jerusalem or Israel at all. I mean, he basically lived his entire life in, you know, modern day Saudi Arabia. So I don't really understand the historical claim that they have to Jerusalem. It doesn't really, and we don't need to go down that road because that would probably take a long time, but I guess I don't quite grasp that.
So I can address maybe part of it. So I think that there's some significance, but it's been dramatized and overblown in order to justify pushing the Jews out. So there isn't really, the strength of the connection that Jews have to Jerusalem far outweighs any connection that Muslims have to that particular area. I mean, bar none. But what the Arab world has done very well is to conflate Jerusalem as something, you know, they've elevated it in modern narrative in order to justify wanting to eradicate the Jews from the region. And it's really troubling to see those in the media fall for this play, because if anyone with an ounce of logic about the situation would have the willingness to go back into the Quran and say, hey, Jerusalem's never mentioned here. So trying to understand, you know, why it's so significant to you. And you'll get a lot of different roundabout answers. But what it really stems down to is, I think, this desire, this very politically strategic narrative that's been created around Jerusalem in the Muslim world. And it's been very practically useful for sort of arguing against the existence of the Israeli state. So that's sort of where I fall on that. It's a politically manipulative tool, the elevation of Israel within, or elevation of Jerusalem within the Muslim narrative, very politically strategic. And it really speaks, again, like you were saying, it should be a non-conversation, but it's this argument that they've created has allowed it to become a conversation. And it has allowed the media to feed off this idea that it's two parties with equal claims to the area when that's just not the case.
On the Israel topic, Nikki Haley, ambassador to the United Nations, who has been a rock star in the administration. I have a lot of problems with some of Trump's cabinet officials, but Nikki Haley's, from where I'm sitting, has done an outstanding job this past year. She smacked around the UN this week on their treatment of Israel and basically said the U.S. isn't going to stand for it anymore. Josiah, you want to play that clip of Nikki Haley real quick?
Yeah.
The Jewish people are a patient people. Throughout 3,000 years of civilization, foreign conquest, exile, and return, Jerusalem has remained their spiritual home. For nearly 70 years, the city of Jerusalem has been the capital of the State of Israel, despite many attempts by others to deny that reality. The American people are less patient, and they have waited and waited. This week, President Trump finally made the decision to no longer deny the will of the American people. It's important to be clear about exactly what the president's decision does. The president has announced that the United States recognizes the obvious, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. He has also instructed the State Department to begin the process of relocating the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The discussion of this issue. Israel, like all nations, has the right to determine its capital city. Jerusalem is the home of Israel's parliament, president, prime minister, Supreme Court, and many of its ministries. It is simple common sense that foreign embassies be located there, reflected an honest assessment of reality. I understand the concern members have in calling this session. Change is hard, but we should never doubt what the truth can do. Finally, I will not let this moment pass without a comment about the United Nations itself. Over many years, the United Nations has outrageously been of the world's foremost centers of hostility towards Israel. The UN has done much more damage to the prospects for Middle East peace than to advance them. We will not be a party to that. The United States no longer stands by when Israel is unfairly attacked in the United Nations. And the United States will not be lectured to by countries that lack any credibility when it comes to treating both Israelis and Palestinians fairly.
Yeah, I mean, this is,
she says it how
this
it
should
is.
Have been said a long time ago.
Yeah.
Right.
The UN has been just a complete sinister entity in regards to Israel for a long time.
Absolutely has. And I think that I love Nikki Haley's sort of ability to draw in the fact that the UN's actions have been detrimental to peace in the area, because essentially what they've done is they've emboldened jihadist groups to think that their actions, their violence and their actions are justified when they're not. And that in and of itself is the biggest detriment to peace. When you embolden terrorist groups like Hamas, and we can argue the PA, since they spend about a tenth of their budget subsidizing terrorism, could also be within the category. They're basically Hamas in suits. That you sort of beg the question, why are you emboldening these actors? You know, and what is the consequence of emboldening such groups of people, right? I mean, those are not people that want peace. Those are not people that are looking towards a sustainable future. I mean, look at this day of rage. They canceled school so that young children could go out and engage in violent protest. That doesn't tell me that that's a country that values its future, right? And when we talk about the creation of a state, right, that's not a society that's valuing its future. Perhaps individual people are, no question. But a government that does not value the future of its society is very alarming. So when they say the creation of a Palestinian state is feasible. I say, look at all the behavior that's been taking place from the two main government systems in power on Palestinian land. Do those actors suggest that they're able to create a sustainable state? And I would argue they're not. And so when it comes to discussing, you know, peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it really starts with Palestinian leadership. And it really starts with individuals within Palestinian leadership not being driven, not cowing to terrorists, but also not supporting terrorists themselves or even being terrorists themselves. And that's going to have to come from within Palestinian society. And that's the unfortunate truth. That's the uncomfortable truth. It's not, no matter, there's not enough land in the world that will eliminate jihadist aims from Palestinian society. There just isn't. Because right. At the end of the day, it's not about land, it's about anti-Semitism.
Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And the political motivator in that area of the world is anti-Semitism. So those are the kind of people who are going to be rising to power.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fact that diplomats from, you know, these anti-Israel countries, I mean, they vote on all these UN resolutions regarding Israel. So shouldn't these diplomats have to recuse themselves from any vote regarding Israel if the stated goal of the country they're representing is to wipe Israel off the map? I feel like that would make a little bit of sense. But let's move on to some stuff happening here in the States. It was a busy week in Congress. Not that they were getting anything done, but it was a busy week regarding congressional resignations. And honestly, I don't think this is over with. This could be like the biggest purge of politicians since the Civil War when it's all said and done, honestly. So before we can go, you know, detail by detail, but just big picture, what do you think about the last week in Congress and where this is heading?
I think that, you know, I've heard reports that we're going to see anywhere from 20 to 40 more congressional members exposed for, very high.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I don't doubt it.
For some kind of sexual misconduct. And so I see this being something that's going to be ongoing, at least for the next several months. And wow. Quite frankly, I think it's a good thing that's happening. I think the fact that we are addressing this now, it's better late than never. And I think that there's something to be said for the bravery of these women for coming forward. Mm-hmm. Clearly, though, there's still a culture of, you know, if these women come forward, they're not going to be believed by the opposite party, which is just such a stupid and inane, you know, reaction. But I do think that, you know, this is sort of a weird cleaning house. I'm not someone that takes, you know, there's some women, though, or not women, you know, it's on both women and men who have sort of taken a weird satisfaction in watching it all burn down. And I think in my mind, this isn't a happy thing. This is sort of, it's sad in the sense that this culture has, this pervasive behavior has been going on and we haven't been aware of it. Or if we have, we've done nothing about it.
Yeah.
And that to me is really unfortunate. So yeah, it will probably be a very dramatic time in Congress now. But you know what? If you really are a pervert, then good riddance.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no reason that you should be using your position of power to intimidate through sexual advances your subordinates. That's just completely inappropriate. So I will be happy to see those who are guilty go.
Yeah,
this is tough though because we've entered a climate now where, if you have make an accusation, most likely you will be believed. Well, maybe, you know, that stands to reason, but there's not really like a trial taking place. You know, this is really the trial of public opinion, which opens up, you know, some tough doors because we want to make sure that this doesn't become a witch hunt as well. You know, that there's opportunity here for fake accusations to be made against people and for those accusations to be really damaging. So it's going to be a tough time because we also need to be prudent about making sure that false accusations aren't lodged and careers aren't ruined as a consequence.
Yeah. It's funny. Trump said he was going to drain the swamp. He didn't really seem to do that, but it seemed to be draining anyway.
I know. It's self-draining. It's self-draining.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. Trump's behavior during the primaries, you know, it's funny. For all the stuff that Clinton did, you think that he would be the one to spur this type of movement, right?
Hmm.
I mean, for engaging in sexual relations with his 20-year-old intern, you'd think that would be, you know, enough to spur the left to wake up. But, you know, of course not.
Right.
Of course not. And of course, you know, every single one of these sexual harassment situations have become political. I mean, both sides are politicizing this. It is kind of gross. A few of the highlights from this week, Representative John Conyers of Michigan announced his retirement, which is I don't know if he thinks that makes him look better instead of just resigning. I guess he figures he's 88 years old, so retirement sounds better. He was accused, I believe, of six. I think it's up to six women now. so he announced his retirement and then endorsed his, and this I'm being 100% serious here, endorsed his 27-year-old drug-dealing son, John Conyers III, to replace him because apparently Detroit, Michigan is some kind of kingdom from 1,000 years ago or something.
Too funny. Well, I mean, it's hilarious to me because it's not like his son was sort of a Robert Kennedy type figure JFK Jr. I mean, this is just sort of, it's very bizarre, but it's politics now. You know, it just shows you how entrenched the political class is. And, you know, that's sort of the living embodiment of why Trump won.
Yeah.
Because it's this attitude of entitlement to the position, this attitude of entitlement to the ruling class that is just completely pervasive in Washington. And that level of entitlement has sort of shielded individuals in the political class from really having to answer to their constituents. And, you know, one of the reasons that Trump was elected, whether you agree or disagree with him, one of the biggest reasons he was elected was as a pushback against this entrenchment of the political class. And Conyers just completely confirmed exactly why Trump was elected, because that behavior is so disgusting, but at least, you know, Conyers was very open about it. So it's pretty humorous and ironic to me, actually.
Yeah, it's weird. This, we're talking about Detroit. It seems like in Detroit, politicians there can literally get away with anything they want and do whatever they want as long as they're wearing blue.
Absolutely. Well, that's going back to the idea that these are entrenched classes of politicians, and the impetus for change isn't really there if you just keep reelecting people who don't get much done.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly Conyers didn't take his position seriously, or he would not have been engaging in sexual misconduct for so long.
All right, I want to move on to Al Franken. We definitely got to talk about his statement this week. But before we do that, I really want to touch on Representative Trent Franks, Republican from, I believe, Texas, who said he is resigning this week. And this is the weirdest shit I've ever heard in my life. He's resigning because apparently 10 years ago or so, he approached a couple female staffers about being a surrogate mother for him and his wife. This is weird. This is really, really weird. The decision-making process based on, I don't understand what would possess a man to ask his subordinates to carry his child. This is a weird one.
Yeah, I think that it sort of speaks to the perverse creativity of some of these congressmen. I mean, it's really despicable and disgusting. But if you think about it, it's completely unusual from the accusations we've heard in the past. That doesn't make it any better. It just makes it, I would say, even more alarming that there are so many different avenues for men to take when it comes to sexual misconduct. You know, like I said, it's never a good thing when we find out about one of these things, but it also does have the sort of inherent good in it, in that someone who is a bad person is no longer going to be representing or serving people. And, you know, it's sort of a mixed bag when it comes to these exposures, because it's saddening, but it's also
Don't really know much about this story, but could you make the case that Trent Franks is not necessarily creatively devious, but rather an idiot?
Perhaps both, yes. I think when I say creative, I don't mean creative like he's sitting and thinking about strategies. I more mean like this is just inherently sort of a very odd way, a roundabout way of going into sexual misconduct. And, you know, like I said, it's not as direct as some of these other men, but it's certainly no less disturbing, because like I said, it just shows you that there's multiple different avenues for sexual misconduct. Yeah,
that's right. And just the decision-making process behind Mr. Franks. I just don't know why he would think that this was a smart idea or an appropriate conversation to have.
He was there were suggestions that he was like in love with some of these women, and that in and of itself is just sort of bizarre to me. There really isn't, it's sort of funny because we're sitting here trying to rationalize what I would argue are irrational actors. Mm. And in and of itself, that's a challenge. That's almost impossible,
right,
to assign sort of rational processes to irrational actors. So, You know, I have no idea. I'm just sort of disgusted and alarmed.
Isn't it just great that in 2017, most of our elected officials are irrational actors?
Yeah.
That just really makes you feel safe and
it does.
Well represented.
It really gives you confidence in the democratic process, right?
Oh, absolutely.
100%. So it's disturbing and upsetting. Yeah.
So Senator Al Franken of Minnesota announced his resignation before the Senate this week. We probably should have pulled up the clip. We don't have it. But he essentially said, I'm resigning, but I didn't really do anything wrong, and Trump sucks. That was basically his speech. So very, very contrite from Mr. Franken.
We don't even know when he's resigning, right? Do we have a date?
Well, I don't think he is resigning. I think Roy Moore is going to win.
Right.
And then he'll just say, well, Roy Moore is just as bad as me, so I'm not going to resign. I give it a 70% chance that's what happens.
Well, look at the, isn't that horrible that moral relativity is what's, like, this is awful. Moral relativism, that's what it is, right? Franken's not going to resign because what he did wrong is absolutely wrong. He's only going to resign if the person around him is not as bad as he is.
Well, it's not morality. It's not morality if you refuse to be moral only if your party gets something out of it. That's not
right.
Morality. That's politics.
No,
that's hardball the way everything else is. And honestly, the only, look, Roy Moore, we talked about this last week, the last couple weeks. I really hope we can stop talking about this at some point soon, sexual harassment. But I wouldn't vote for Roy Moore personally. It doesn't matter how bad the Democrat is. I think best case scenario, Moore wins and then the Senate expels him. I mean, Tim Scott of South Carolina, Ben Sass of Nebraska, Susan Collins of Maine, a lot of GOP senators have said that if Moore wins, they'll seat him because they have to, but they'll immediately open up an investigation and you know, that could certainly lead to the Senate removing him. But look, Bob Menendez of New Jersey is accused of much worse stuff than Moore or Franken. The only difference is Chris Christie, a Republican, is the governor of New Jersey. So if Bob Menendez resigns, you know, they lose that seat. And Mark Dayton, the governor of Minnesota, is a Democrat. And he already said he's replacing Franken with his lieutenant governor, who's a very, very liberal woman. So it doesn't cost the Democratic Party anything at all. I mean, this is just politics. It, literally, these people's morality is solely based on the party of the governor of their state. I mean, this does not seem like morality to me.
Right. No, absolutely. So, that shouldn't be what's happening. It should be, I would support a congressional investigation into sexual misconduct if Roy Moore were elected, because that is the right thing to do. Obviously, in a perfect world, we would have a better candidate than Roy Moore. And I personally would not, if I were an Alabama voter, I would not be able to vote for Roy Moore. But that being said, if he were to win, I would hope that we would be able to address those allegations and eject him from the Senate. But, you know, that again, that's sort of, I'm not an Alabama voter, but again, I would not be able to vote for him. None of his responses to the accusations have been good enough for me to say, yeah, you know what, maybe these accusations are just fabricated. I haven't gotten, in fact, I've gotten his responses have made more incriminating than mitigating my feeling that he is someone that engaged in this sexual perverted behavior. So
yeah,
that's where I stand on it. But, you know, obviously there have been, I've seen a lot of people on Twitter come up with justifications for Roy Moore. And I think if we are the party of, you know, strong Judeo-Christian moral values, and that's something that we purport to be important to us, to see someone with this sort of behavior, to see people explain away this behavior is really troubling.
All right, Ariel, one last thing before we wrap. We always end the show with something positive, something completely non-political, something that you've been into this last week, whether it's a book you're reading or a TV show you're into or an album you're listening to. Give us something that the audience should check out.
This is a political TV show, but it's a really good one. I've been watching Veep nonstop, and I just got into it, and I have to tell you, it's a dismal view of politics, but it's really fun. Funny show. And I really enjoyed it. So that's something I'd recommend to people if they're looking for something sort of a lighthearted take on politics. Veep is pretty good.
Okay. Yeah, I should watch that. I've seen the advertisements for it, but I'm always a little bit skeptical with political shows.
So. It's great. It doesn't try to jam any narrative down your throat. In fact, it sort of makes fun of the motions that politicians go through in order to appeal to different groups within society. Oh, so if anything, it's sort of, it's funny from that perspective. It's really, you can watch it and be from any party, and they've really skirted that line really nicely, actually.
Oh, very nice. I have to check that out.
All right. Cool, guys. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this. And I hope that you guys have a good rest of your Sunday.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Oh, before, can you want to plug your Twitter real quick or anything like that?
Yeah, feel free if you want to follow me on Twitter. I'm Political L, so the word political and then E-L-L-E. You can find me on Twitter. I'm fairly Twitter active. I enjoy sort of engaging in banter, so definitely follow me on there if you want. But thank you guys again so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It was really nice meeting you both. Have a good afternoon.
You too.
All right. That was Ariel Davidson, everybody. Great guest. That was a great chat. Yeah. Everybody make sure you follow her on Twitter. Check her out. Check out her stuff at The Federalist. And yeah, hopefully we'll have her back soon.
She's one of those people, it's like if you hang around them long enough, you'll get smarter.
Yeah, she's much, much smarter than we are. So
yeah.
I feel a little bad about myself, but I'm really glad we had her on the show.
Yeah. Hey, what is your positive thing for the week, Brady? Hey, we didn't really bring it down at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
What?
We did not. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
First time in a long time. Actually, I think we have a joint thing to end the podcast,
yeah,
Josiah.
Yeah, a joint.
Let's talk about a little bit about your boy, Lomachenko.
Vasily Lomachenko. He's freaking...
How do you pronounce his first name? I always F up the first name.
I guess it's Vasil.
Vasil?
Yeah, Vasily Lomachenko. Literally the hardest name for me to get. All right, he is a boxer. He's my favorite boxer. And I can't remember his name 90% of the time.
This son of a bitch is literally going to go down as like one of the greatest of all time. I'm calling it right now.
If anyone can remember his name.
Homeboy. I mean, he'd already be like the most famous boxer on the planet if his name was like John or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If his name was John Smith or, you know, from Ontario, he'd be freaking the biggest. He'd be the next Muhammad Ali. He's incredible.
Well, we got to talk a little bit about the fight from last night. This was ridiculous.
Yeah. Ridiculous. The guy's name, he all right, so there was a big fight last night. Sorry, guys, we kind of got ahead of ourselves there. I stayed up late for me to watch this big fight, to watch the main card. It's first time in boxing history two-time gold medalists fought against each other. And it was for a championship, and we're talking, and so the guy who's facing him was, how do you say his name? Rigondeaux. He's a Cuban champion, world beater, undefeated fighter, went up a couple weight classes to fight him and just got completely humiliated.
Yeah, it was not a fight. It was an absolute ass kicking. And Rigondeaux, he's what, a 2-time gold medalist. He's an undefeated world champ, and he had nothing for Lomachenko. Watching Lomachenko work it's art.
Yes.
I mean, they call it the sweet science for a reason. This guy, I mean, his footwork, his speed, accuracy. I mean, he was painting a picture out there, and it was amazing to watch. And if anybody hasn't seen it, probably most of you guys have not seen it, because nobody watches boxing anymore.
Yeah.
Definitely look up.
This is our favorite guy, and we didn't even know he was fighting until last night, which was the night of the fight.
Yeah, I texted him. I'm like, dude, Lomachenko's fighting tonight.
If you would have texted me, I wouldn't even known. And it was on ESPN. It wasn't even a pay-per-view. But seriously, this guy is the greatest thing I've ever seen in boxing. Like, I pretty much gave up on boxing for like 10 years almost. And this guy is completely changing, like re-changing my perspective on boxing. He's reinventing the game. So basically just go, all you have to do is go to YouTube and watch like a highlight reel of Vasil Lomachenko. They call him High Tech. It's his nickname. So that will be worth
not
it.
Not a great nickname. Not the best nickname, I will say.
Give him a break. I mean, he can barely speak English.
That's true.
They probably think he's cool and trained.
They I saw an interview, or maybe they were just talking about it on the broadcast, I think. Lomachenko's father was like an Olympic boxer, I think, too. And this is just, dude, Eastern Europeans are by far the scariest white people.
Yes. They're not.
You know what I mean? Like, there's no scarier white people than like Ukrainians and Russians, and Lomachenko's from the Ukraine, I believe. But yeah, there's some scary white people over there. But they said his father knew that his son was going to be a world champ, and the interviewer asked him, when did you know that your son was going to be world champ? And he said, before he was conceived. That's so weird. That's a weird way to answer that question. But, and also, only a Ukrainian or somebody in Eastern Europe would answer a question that way, I think. But anyway, check it out. Even if you don't like boxing, you might become a boxing fan after watching this son of a bitch fight.
Yeah.
And thank you guys so much for listening to the No Gimmicks podcast this week. We will be back next week. If you haven't already, I don't know what the hell's wrong with you, but you know, definitely subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud or Google Play. Please give us a 5-star rating and a good review. We always appreciate that. And we appreciate every single one of you guys. We love you. We'll talk to you next week. No gimmicks.
No gimmicks.